You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Colston Jones. I'm from the Office of the Public Defender at Chesapeake. I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Granato. The appellant, Your Honor, in this case is requesting that the matter be remanded to the Court of Appeals of Virginia for consideration on the merits of the case. In this case, the Court of Appeals did basically deny the petition for appeal, having found that the statement of facts, which was submitted in this case in lieu of a transcript, had not been properly filed with the trial court. But as hopefully the court has had an opportunity to see through the pleadings in the matter, this was a case where the initially submitted draft statement of facts and notice of presentation of statement of facts was not initially transmitted by the clerk of the trial court to the Court of Appeals of Virginia. And when that became apparent, it was informally requested that the clerk of the trial court do so, and the clerk of the trial court in fact did that. And just to make it clear, the documents that were initially omitted from being transmitted to the clerk of the Court of Appeals are found in the joint appendix of this case at pages 8 through 17 of the joint appendix.
May I ask you this?
Yes, sir.
Can you dwell on the points you made in your, well, in both your reply and your opening brief about the timing of the writ of certiorari remedy and its exclusivity? Because that, to me, is one of the most difficult questions in the case.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position with regard to that is that if you review the statutes that discuss the writ of certiorari, 8.01.673 for this court and 8.01.675.4 for the Court of Appeals, each of those statutes are quite similar, and they use permissive language. They recite that the respective court may issue a writ of certiorari so that the record can be made complete.
But Godfrey seems to tighten that up pretty much, at least at a certain point. The question, I think, is what point does it do that?
Our best response to that, Your Honor, is that Godfrey is quite specific that that is after a petition for appeal has been granted. In this case, in the Court of Appeals of Virginia, the petition for appeal was never granted. And as we discussed in the reply brief, perhaps one reason for that is that once the petition for appeal is granted, the rules of court that apply to this court as well as to the Court of Appeals require that an appendix be prepared and filed. And it seems to me that at that point, it is entirely reasonable to require that the writ of certiorari be the exclusive means of amplifying or fulfilling or completing the record.
The thinking is at the time of the appendix, pretty much all parties realize, okay, now we got to make sure we've got exactly what we need and nothing's in here that shouldn't be in here, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor. At that point, it's the court that should be determining what is to be included in the record by issuing the writ, but not up until that point. And to my mind, the language from the case is quite specific that, after a petition for appeal or after an appeal has been granted. So that's our best response to that question. In addition, we also just do respectfully point out sort of rules of court 5A10D and also the analog for this court 513C, which provide that no appeal should be dismissed for failure to transmit the record. Frankly, to my mind, it would be hard to conceive of a case where those rules might be given effect if they're not to be given effect in this case. That similar policy is also set out in the statute 801. 679, although that is more specifically referring to the failure of the trial court and the clerk of the trial court to transmit the record in a timely fashion. But to my mind, that is more support for the policy and the rationale that are present in 5A10D and 513C.
But isn't that sort of what's going on here? Is 679 is that it wasn't timely? It shows up February 2015, still prior to a petition being granted and still prior to the record being examined for purposes of compiling a joint appendix.
The only reason I just do point that out is that in Rule 5, which is governing appeals that are directly to be taken to this court, there are some more firm time deadlines for the transmission of the record. So I just was wanting to just sort of be conscientious and point out to the court that there is a specific language about timeliness in 801-679 that I do not find in the and the rules of court 5A10B and 513C, but Your Honor's point is certainly well taken. And, if it would please the court, I'm happy to rest on the brief, but maybe if I could answer any additional questions of the court. Or,
may I just ask a question about Godfrey and 673 and 6745? I'm looking at the rules, and the rules don't include the language in Godfrey after the appeal has been granted. And I'm trying to, as you all are, figure out, was that a function of the facts in Godfrey that the appeal had been granted? Is that a function of the fact that the matter, just the Court of Appeals may not take jurisdiction over a case until after the appeal has been granted? What do you have a position as to what the source of that language is?
I do not. And that's a question that I wish I were able to answer. I think it would be quite helpful, but I guess in response to that question, Your Honor, I would say that I only find that language, in those cases. I don't know where the origin of that language after the petition for appeal has been granted.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You have 8 minutes and 44 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. And I think the Court's already zeroed in on the issue here. Every one of the cases we have discussing the writ of certiorari the last several decades has included that language about after an appeal has been granted. If you go back to Old Dominion, which is cited in Godfrey, I think that's the first case where that language occurred. It sets it forth, gives no explanation. Doesn't seem to be any explanation anywhere as to why that would make a difference.
Wouldn't the difference be that there's a certain period of informality between the clerk's office of the Court of Appeals and a trial court's clerk's office in having the record certified? So if a record comes in that has apparently an obvious omission, tell me if I'm wrong on this, I don't think it's unheard of that the clerks will have some exchange among themselves, and the record may be supplemented and then ultimately certified by the Court of Appeals. But all of that process happens before a petition is granted and an appendix is put together. So if that's true, I'm not asserting it, I'm just hypothesizing it, wouldn't that explain why this language seems to appear in most of our cases?
Your Honor, I really don't know. Of course, the procedure, of course, is pretty formalistic at this point. What we do is the clerk has to certify that this is a true and complete record. And it doesn't do that until after it has received the statement of facts and retained it for 21 days to allow counsel, the parties, to examine it. So you have a record that at that point has been exposed for review, if the attorneys want to do that, and the clerk then certifies it. It seems to me that you have a certified record before you. If anybody wants to make a change to it at that point, it seems to me that the appellate court should control that issue. Don't forget, the court of appeals acquired jurisdiction in this case not when the appeal was granted, but when the appeal was filed. So it's the court that's in charge at this point, the appellate court, what's going to be in the record. And it seems to me that it's just as important to have everything in it that should be there at the petition stage, so that you don't grant or deny a petition in the absence of important documents.
But doesn't that play into exactly what Justice Kelsey said? It's important to have everything there, and if you find something isn't there, there should be this informal process to make sure it comes from the trial court, it ends up in the record, so that it can be considered by the court.
I don't know why the process should be informal. That is, there is a formal process.
Are you talking about this statute?
Yeah, the registration act, which does not...
Well, let me ask you what about this, because... The first language in this statute, 8.01.675.4, says when a case has previously been in an appellate court. What do you think that means? Because it's not talking about now. It's talking about previously this case has been in the court.
prior cases when this particular...
So do you think that's all this statute applies to is prior cases?
No. I think it applies to that it may review older cases and it may additionally, in any case, bring up the records that have been, the parts of the records that have been excluded. And that the statute itself makes no distinction between the time periods, the events in the course of the litigation. And it seems to me that this court and any appellate court would be just as concerned about allowing changes to the record only after it has said, yes, that's necessary. We don't want the clerks deciding what should be in the record after it's already been certified that this is a true and complete record. We want the appellate court to make that determination. In every case, that is, if in fact there's something missing from the record, the writ of certiorari should permit the court to say, yes, we want that, yes, we don't want that, to let the court determine what is appropriate to the record beyond what's already been certified as a true and complete
copy. May I ask you this, though, but the court's not doing that here. The court's not saying, you know what, we've looked at this August 18 series of documents. It's not clear to us it was actually filed. There was no cert petition granted, cert writ granted, so we're not going to consider it. They didn't come to closure on whether that really should be considered. The logic is, and understandably, that following our case law is, well, there was no writ issued, therefore, whether it would have been granted if a writ had been issued is not before us. Isn't that the logic that they use?
That's correct, right? But of course, since there was no request for the writ, we don't know what they would have done. And the point is that the first opinion in the Court of Appeals is entirely correct. The record as presented does not establish that there was a timely filed statement of facts. The question is then how should the defendant in this case change the record? And it seems to me at that point, after the court has already acted and denied a petition, he would want to supervise the change made to the record.
When the August 18 documents made it to the Court of Appeals before the three-judge review, did the clerk certify it? I mean, it didn't come from the parties. It came from the trial court.
Came from the trial court, yes, sir.
So the trial court clerk is doing it. It's late. It should have been part of the original package. But wasn't that in the nature of a certification? For all I know, it was accompanied by a certification.
Well, there was a second certification.
Well, for heaven's sakes.
But I mean, the point is that the trial court has no power to change the record once the appeal, the record has been sent up. That is under the control of the appellate court.
According to what?
According to the writ of certiorari.
The statute doesn't say that.
And the cases.
The statute doesn't say that. It doesn't say the clerk can't do without a writ of certiorari.
It doesn't say that. No, it says that the court may do it. And
why?
And the courts have interpreted, this court has interpreted that statute to mean that the court cannot do it once the appeal has been granted.
Right.
Now, why they made a difference, I don't know. I mean, perhaps you're correct that they said, well, let's try to preserve informality up to that point. But no one's ever said that. All we have are a number of cases where they have simply said, once the appeal has been granted, the writ of certiorari is required. There are some older cases going way back where they used the writ of certiorari in earlier instances, which, of course, we haven't briefed at this point because raised for the first time in reply brief. But I think the traditional use, in one case, the Supreme Court directed a writ of certiorari to examine the records to determine whether they had jurisdiction over the matter. And I believe I'm unable to determine exactly when that happened in the process because I think it's 138 Virginia or something of that nature. But I think the court, all I can argue is that I don't know why the court made that. I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe there are good reasons for doing that. Maybe the court can set that forth if it wishes. But it seems to me that if, in fact, the court wants to preserve the integrity of its records, it may well say, we want to supervise any change to the record after the circuit court has told us that this is the true and complete record. We'd prefer not to have the record coming in produced by other people without the input from this court when, in fact, a change to the appellate record. And here it's made not before the petition stage, before the petition was heard, raised after the petition is initially denied. The Court of Appeals has acted, and the question is, when in that situation, where the court has rendered an opinion, can the party change the record without any input from the court or any control from the court?
And I think the answer would be clearly not. So if there was a contest and the Commonwealth said, you know, the August 18 documents are in fact not in the trial court record and there's been a mistake here, what no doubt would have happened, there would have been a remand order saying to the clerk of the trial court, here's the contest, you and the trial judge reserve it, present your recertification, and then in the end, the Court of Appeals has the ultimate discretion to make its own call.
Commissioner.
So, I mean, they're not losing power over the case before them. The question is, should they exercise that power? Because that's what's not happened here. They've not exercised that power.
Commissioner.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I mean, I understand that the difficulty I see is why at any stage is the writ of certiorari absolutely essential as the only method of changing the record if it's not really essential at earlier stages in the proceedings. And I would suggest that on that basis, the writ was required here or should be determined to be required. And for that reason, I would request that the decision below be affirmed. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
I would waive rebuttal unless there are any additional questions. I certainly thank the court for the opportunity to appear today.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.